talk around the theme of disenchantment. And I'm kind of a little bit intrigued by this word. And together with the word disillusionment, I find it has a very kind of odd double meaning almost in our language. The usual way we use the word disenchantment or disillusionment is somewhat, it comes with a kind of feeling of kind of being dismayed or discouraged or disappointed in something. Something didn't live up to what it should be, so we were disillusioned in it. And often then it can come perhaps with a feeling of depression and sadness or grief or anger or something. Being disenchanted and disillusioned is sometimes considered to be a bad thing. But the literal meaning of the word disenchantment is to stop being enchanted. And disillusionment is to stop being an illusion. And that seems to me an imminently very good thing to happen. And so disenchantment maybe you know, has two sides to it. It has a side of being disappointed in things, but it also has the side of something actually quite positive and useful. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about disenchantment. There's a discourse of the Buddha where a man, maybe a philosopher, comes to see the Buddha and engages him, asks him a whole series of questions to try to find out how what the Buddha's position was on certain metaphysical principles or ideas having to do with the nature of consciousness or the nature of self. And maybe something like, you know, could have been... You know, do you believe that there is a self? Do you believe there's not a self? Do you believe there's neither self nor not a self? You know, does a consciousness continue after death? Does a consciousness not continue after death? And the Buddha wasn't interested in having any position on those. That's very interesting in itself. So this guy, after a while, I guess maybe even in frustration, said, well, you know, there was a term for people back in Buddha's time called eel wrigglers. And those are people who wouldn't take any position on anything. So, but the Buddha wasn't considered to be one of these. But he wouldn't take, some things he wouldn't take a position on. So finally this man said, well, what do you teach? You know, if you don't, and the Buddha said, well, what I teach is the Four Noble Truths. I teach that there's suffering, I teach that there's a cause for suffering, I teach there's an end to suffering, and there's a path, a prescription to follow to end suffering. So that's pretty basic Buddhism. And then the man asked, why do you teach that? Why do you teach the Four Noble Truths? And then the Buddha said, oh, I teach the Four Noble Truths because it's conducive to disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, and nirvana, or enlightenment, or awakening. The words were nibbida, viraga, nirodha, and nibbana. And so the fundamental teaching that he had, that he was teaching, was not for some kind of system of belief or faith, but rather for something experiential, something to be attained, and which he defined in this case to be disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, and enlightenment itself. And some people can understand those four to be synonyms, and some people understand them to be kind of stages that people go through, one after the other. But he starts with this thing called disenchantment. The word in Pali is nibbida, not to be confused with nibbana. And nibbida has been translated into English a number of different ways. Disenchantment is nowadays the most common, sometimes as disillusionment. Occasionally, the translation is turning away from something. And back in the Victorian era, when the English were translating Buddhist texts and didn't know quite what they were doing, they translated it as revulsion, which lent a certain idea that maybe Buddhism was world-negating. You know. But disenchantment was an important term of what the Buddha was trying to teach. So it has a place. And what I want to do, you know, is to focus on a little bit today. And I thought in talking about this, it might be an unpopular talk. But you know, that's okay. Yet another. So disenchantment. Well, I think we need to look a little bit at what we're enchanted with. And many of us are enchanted by different things. And we're enchanted by wealth, by status, by power, by the allure of certain relationships or relationships in the abstract. We're enchanted by religious goals, religious teachings, religious teachers. We're enchanted by material goods. Consumerism, advertisement has a lot to do with enchanting people. We're enchanted by college degrees, or getting degrees and certificates and certifications. There's many things that people are enchanted by, but what does it mean to be enchanted? Enchanted, I think, means to believe or have the illusion that somehow these pursuits are going to offer us some kind of ultimate security or ultimate satisfaction or ultimate happiness, that if we only have these things, then we'll live happily ever after. If we have these things, some kind of ultimate result will happen, that this is going to be my savior, this is going to do it for me. And some people will have this in relationship to money and power and jobs and promotions. And some people will see through those things, and some people then will then take spiritual themes and ideas as being what enchants them. And enchantment is fed, is fueled by things like discontent, is fueled by a sense of dis-ease or loneliness or insecurity. And it's fueled by hope often, the hope that something will do it for me, something, if I get this, then I can attain something, then everything will be okay. And it can be very, very seductive, the enchantments. And we might not kind of think some of the things we're enchanted by will give us ultimate well-being. But if we look at how we act, it seems that, you know, functionally that's kind of the role they have in life. And many of us, I think, can look back into our life and see, you know, things that we were enchanted by or things that we really thought were really important and really needed to get. And maybe we got them, maybe we didn't. And we look back and say, what was that about? You know, that's not, you know, that didn't live up to what I was hoping it would do for me. Or as soon as we have it, then we, you know, as soon as we have the bachelor's degree, then we're feel, well, if only had a master's and only a PhD. A PhD will only if, you know, I didn't do those things. you know, and as people get disenchanted sometimes, they realize the hollowness or the emptiness. It's a common expression. Some people feel, oh, it was really empty to have just to have a certificate, to have a diploma, to have a PhD in Buddhist studies. It's kind of empty. You know, it doesn't really seem to hold much. And so I want to ask you all a little bit, what are some of the things that you've been enchanted with in your past that you're no longer enchanted by? Alcohol. Enchanted, that's a good one. Does a good job. Yes. Julie.
Technology.
How are you enchanted by technology?
How was I?
Yeah.
How have I been?
Yeah.
At a very early age, I was very taken with the thought that technology would improve the quality of my.
So one of my professors who disconnected her email and found that the quality of her life improved. Someone else. Just speak up.
I'm sort of asking the question about the goals I had that I reached that I'm glad I did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like education, like keeping my weight down, having persevered with things that were difficult.
Uh-huh.
It isn't that I have the same goal anymore because my tastes have changed, but I'm awfully glad that I had those enchantments.
Ah, glad you had those enchantments. So you're a little bit ahead of me in terms of the how this talk was supposed to unfold. You know, it's you know, now I'm getting disillusioned. And the question was, you know, much narrower. You know, actually, what were you enchanted with? You're no longer enchanted with now. And we'll talk about, you know, those kind of your points a little bit later. Yes, Bill?
It seems there's a drive in everyone to be enchanted. Where did that drive come from? What's the source of it?
I suggested a few sources of it, or a few things that fuel it before: the insecurity, the loneliness, the feeling of dissatisfaction, disease, the feeling of lack, of inadequacy. And it's also then coming out of that, there can be hope or longing. Hope and longing fuels a lot of enchantment. You know, to get more deeply into the source, I don't know if we need to. But do you have a suggestion?
No, it seems to be universal that people see that which is not there.
Right. And you know, it seems like we're going off into, you know, you guys, I guess most of you haven't been enchanted particularly with things. Yes?
I was single in my 30s, but this was, you know, something I wanted to get married. I was very enchanted with the idea of getting married. And then finally at 37, I got married, and I'm no longer enchanted. Right. You know, I feel like it's a happy marriage, but I just had this that it was just going to do something for me, and guess what? I still have to, you know, live my life and take responsibility for it. There was no magic that happened when I got married.
Great, thank you. Deborah.
I've been enchanted by the idea of being different.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, so being enchanted by the idea of being special and different.
What if you're still enchanted with the same thing? Self-improvement is what I've been enchanted with, and I still am.
So Yvonne says that she's still enchanted with the idea of self-improvement. Do you have a sense of how you're enchanted? The allure, the enchantment,
it's just very strong in me.
Very strong.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I have the idea that it's going to solve things for me. Uh-huh. And I don't think it does.
So the idea, I would suggest probably, it's not just simply an idea, but that idea is infused with hope or longing.
Uh-huh.
A hope that it'll do something for you.
Uh-huh.
So the enchantment of self-improvement. And, you know, without wanting to go into this subject too much now, you know, if there is no self to improve, you'll be trying for a long time. Yes?
Speaking enlightenment.
The allure, the seduction of enlightenment. Enlightenment will do it. Suzuki Roshi said that it's possible that once you get... He said, it's possible you get enlightened. And it's possible that when you get enlightened, you'll be disappointed. someone gave me a cartoon a few weeks ago of these two Zen monks, you know, sitting in a monastery, kind of talking to each other, and one said something, you know, after reading all those books about enlightenment, I couldn't help but be disappointed when it finally happened. So, what else have you been enchanted by? Yes, Nancy.
Don't you think that
legends and fairy tales. From time to time I go back and I read those again. And really, there's always disappointment, of course, and disillusionment, but they sort of broke on, don't you think?
Possible.
They're so important.
Mm-hmm. So what's happening, some of you, is that you're wanting to give the exception or wanting to give the, you know, the rationale or how these things really work positively in our life. And that's, it's very valid to do that, but my question for everyone is, you know, trying to keep it a little bit more narrow without the, yes?
I think being a parent is a good place to look, because I should speak on myself. I thought that I could make my kids turn out better than I had, and maybe they would have fewer weaknesses or whatever.
Yes, and I realized that I said so a little bit enchanted. I had enchanted or illusionary idea what parenting would be like, and I've been divested of some of that enchantment now. So, yes.
Success in the workplace.
Uh-huh. So again, you know, there's nothing wrong with pursuits necessarily. What we're focusing on is the enchantment with the pursuit. So, in that you were enchanted with it, how were you enchanted?
Just, you know, to become the senior something, and then to become the manager of something, and then to be the director of something. It was always like the next step would be, I've arrived successful.
And once you arrived?
I was positively impacted by corporate acquisition.
By what? Oh, corporate acquisition.
Yeah, got out of the whole game and happened to success.
Yes?
Maybe it's a guy thing for people who grew up in the 50s and 60s, but it's a automobiles.
Right.
The enchantment of desiring automobiles because of their power and the noise they make when they're charged. Nothing to do with actual utility matter. I was walking past the Corvette dealership on El Camino and then I parked there and realized, I don't want a Corvette anymore. It was a time of my life when they had glow. It had nothing to do with it. The car itself.
There's many things that we're enchanted by, and I think, you know, we can kind of, the word is a strong word, but it takes also very mild forms. Any form where we think that we imagine, have some imagination or some, that this is really going to do it for me, and we find out that the thing itself wasn't really the what needed to be filled. I mean, if we're feeling discontent in our life, if we feel some deep discontent in our deep psyche or deep inside, and we expect that something like food is going to satisfy our deep sense of alienation or discontent, we can be enchanted by what food's going to do for us, for example. And the food gives us pleasure and might numb us out a little bit, but it doesn't really address the real issue of discontent in a deep way. And so the enchantment can at times actually not only be a limiting, but can actually reinforce the very thing that we're trying to fill or trying to correct or heal from. So sometimes the pursuit of external, anything external, objects for our pleasure, for our happiness, can be a very misplaced search for happiness and well-being. Now, it isn't that pursuits, in Buddhism, it isn't that the idea that, you know, we're supposed to give up all our pursuits and stop. It isn't that pursuits or activities or objects are necessarily wrong, but what we want to look at in the practice is that issue of the enchantment with them. What is it we've invested with them? What is our relationship to it? And is it possible in a healthy way to become, is it useful, is it, does it have a place to be positively disenchanted with it? And I think what Elaine pointed out, it can be a little bit of a trap. There are ways in which certain emotions or certain enchantments or certain feelings can give us a lot of fuel and power to get things done. And since getting things done and accomplished have a high value, sometimes we can succeed. And then we feel, oh, that was really good. And so therefore, it was very useful to do this, and we should validate it. And let me try to enchant my children so they can also be successful or whatever. And I'm a little bit suspicious of this, and I don't want to be the authority with a definitive statement on this subject. But for example, people sometimes come to the defense of anger for that reason. If they get angry, then they can really get a lot done. So anger is really a positive thing. And what I would like to suggest as a counter to that is that maybe there are other ways to get just as much done that's not being fueled by enchantment or the kind of hope or longing or something that enchantment provides. And I hope that's the case, because I think that what practice is trying to do is to find for us that sense of motivation that can fuel us to be active in the world, where we don't have to have an illusion or have an enchantment or have an allure, some kind of false sense of hope to get us to kind of do things and get on with things. In Thailand, in Thai Buddhism, this word nibbida, which is translated as disenchantment, is closely connected or understood to be connected to the word maturation, to mature. That as people mature, I think, is often a natural sense of seeing through some of the things that enchanted us as we were younger. And it's considered to be a healthy process, perhaps, to mature and kind of see through, you know. Some people, they mature later than others. Some people, maybe it's not until they retire, they realize that getting lots of money wasn't what it was made up to be, or wasn't really what was going to do it for them. They get lots of money and big houses and many Corvettes, and they realize that they're still unhappy. And so that, you know, and if they're lucky, they'll learn something from that unhappiness. What the sad thing is that if our enchantments let us down, if we get disenchanted, it's actually an uncomfortable feeling to be disenchanted. You feel some discontent or some dissatisfaction. And so it's kind of unpleasant. And if a person hasn't learned through, for example, mindfulness practice, to recognize, to learn to be present for unpleasant situations in an equanimous way, in a gracious way, and if they haven't learned to learn deeply what's really going on with them when they're feeling some displeasure, they might actually just feel the discontent and go looking for something else, some other enchantment. Well, it wasn't sex that was going to do it, so maybe, you know, it's going to be, let's go to India and get enlightened, or let's go traveling, maybe, or let's do something in order to kind of build up my who I am. And I think the process of getting disenchanted or feeling a kind of discontent with certain pursuits, with the way we were enchanted with certain pursuits, is actually a healthy part of any spiritual practice. And it's not very often said that, and certainly in our scene, in the Dharma scene, in the Buddhist teaching scene in America. I think partly, I suspect, because there's a very, very strong preference in American culture, in American Buddhist culture, for world affirmation, to have a very world-affirming teaching. And so anything that can lend itself to the idea that it's not being world-affirming, that's being world-negating, is kind of shied away from. And the idea that there's maybe a positive place for discontent, a positive place for disenchantment, then it's not talked about so much because that doesn't sound world-affirming. But I think actually there's an extremely healthy place for discontent, a certain kind of discontent. So, for example, if we look at someone who's, you know, lives on Wall Street, they have a little apartment on Wall Street, and they go down to the stock market every day, and her whole life is about just getting lots of money and pursuing money and just getting, you know, at any cost, and stays up until the middle of the night, you know, just poring over the web and looking at the stock companies, and gets up at 4 o'clock in the morning to do it again, and works through the weekend, and rushing here and there, and bowling over people because to get more money and get the better deal in the stock market or whatever, and just the whole life is consumed with making money, living that kind of life and smoking cigarettes and all that. I'm just trying to paint a dire picture here. Most of us here in this room, I believe, if we somehow magically found ourselves transported to that person's body, living that life, would probably feel pretty discontented, disillusioned, discouraged. This is not what I want to do. Some of us would feel like we were touching a hot skillet. because that life is so painful. It's so, you know, so filled with illusion and so empty dreams. Anything that has any lasting, real human value is, you know, has no place in the pursuit, the act of busyness. There's this wonderful quote by Thomas Burton. To allow oneself to be carried away by a multitude of conflicting concerns, to surrender to too many demands, to commit oneself to too many projects, to want to help everyone and everything, is to succumb to violence. And so there's all kinds of pursuits that we're enchanted with. We feel we really need to do them, and we have to do them. And, you know, I think fundamentally Buddhist practice is not a critique of any particular pursuit in and of itself. So we don't have to necessarily stop what we're doing. But it's really a critique of the ways in which we get enchanted by those pursuits. And by that enchantment, actually suffer more. And part of the process of coming to happiness, a deep, deep, real secure happiness, which is what nirvana is to realize that anything external to us, anything that we latch on to externally, this is going to really be my savior, this is really going to do it for me. As long as we do that, we're not really going to find that real phenomenal peace and happiness which resides inside of us if we learn to rest in a place that doesn't need anything. Doesn't need to be anywhere, doesn't need to talk to anyone, doesn't need to have any particular relationship, doesn't need anything at all. And to find that place, that it's actually a place of tremendous strength. And because it's a place of strength, it takes some doing to touch it, to find it, it takes strength to find strength. So this place doesn't need anything. It's not an empty place. It's not a place of nothingness, but it's actually a place that is strength, of stability, of well-being. And to be able to come to that, there has to be strength of resolve, of determination, of wisdom, of insight, of commitment, of really knowing ourselves well, knowing ourselves inside and out thoroughly. So we can really see our enchantments and our illusions that we live under and begin and feeling discontent with those kind of enchantment and being willing to stay there in that discontent, have the kind of strength to stay there in that discontent and not immediately fill it with something else. And see what happens if we stay in that discontent, or let that discontent fuel us with the resolve and the strength of purpose to come back and rest, or to find that place that doesn't need anything. The happiness doesn't need anything external. External includes our health. You know, it doesn't includes our emotional life. That is that place inside of us. So there's two kinds of disenchantment in Buddhism. There's a worldly disenchantment. I don't know if that's the best word. That arises out of maturation, out of seeing life, like we talked about this evening to some degree. And almost anyone has access to this kind of worldly discontent or worldly disenchantment. However, the insight meditation practice, in helping us find that place, that stillness, that peaceful place in the center, has a different kind of, there's a different level of disenchantment that arises when the mindfulness practice itself is quite strong. And the mindfulness, in the mindfulness, strength of the mindfulness practice, we realize the phenomenal impermanence of all our experience. Not just simply in the obvious kind of ways but in the moment-to-moment experience, things are constantly in flux and moving. And when in our experience things are constantly flowing and in flux, we realize that we actually, it doesn't make any sense, or it's actually unsatisfactory to let any kind of movement towards or away from any object at all happen. That is actually not, you get disentangled or disillusioned that anything at all can give you any kind of lasting security and happiness, any experience at all. And when in deep meditation this kind of disenchantment arises, it usually arises with a lot of joy, by the way, so don't have to be worried about, you know, those of you who are worried, this is a bad news. There also then is born not an enchantment with the idea of liberation and freedom, but almost what I call a biological imperative, a strong desire. It's almost like the person then sees the possibility of being free, because they see that there's no object, no thing which is going to do it. And then the desire for freedom arises, and part of that desire then is freedom is not a thing, so you can't turn towards it and latch onto it. So what it becomes a turning towards, and in kind of simple terminology, turning towards an openness. It's like opening a window to see what comes through. And it's very frightening. To some degree, it can be frightening, because if you open the door, you don't know what's on the other side. It can be frightening. So you're opening to an unknown. But when the disenchantment is strong enough in the practice, and the person really fully turns the mind to openness, it's really openness to something unknown that's not an object. And this is also in a very important part of the practice. In deep practice. So anyway, questions? Bill.
Unsourceful.
Oh, I don't have to define that.
Unsourceful would be the enchantment.
Oh, I see. Well, faith maybe is closely connected to confidence. And there needs to be a certain amount of confidence in order to be engaged in a practice. And without some kind of confidence that when you sign up for a class at the junior college, you're going to take Spanish. You have to have some confidence that the teacher is going to teach you Spanish and knows Spanish. You know, we don't know that by fact. It hasn't been proved to us yet, so we have some confidence. So there has to be some confidence. And faith, you know, faith maybe is a little bit more heartfelt. Faith can easily slide over to longing and hope. And this is why some people get disenchanted with Buddhism and with practice and with teachers and teachings and all that. It's actually considered to be maybe a very healthy step in a person's spiritual life to get totally disillusioned with their spiritual path. And I say that seriously, to actually do a meditation practice or just be involved in Buddhism, and at some point to get disenchanted with Buddhism could actually be the most necessary thing that needs to happen to you. And the trick is, when you get disenchanted, is not to then check out and go check out the Sufis, necessarily. The Sufis are great. But, you know, the same process works for the Sufis. You know, when you get disenchanted with the Sufis, then, you know, don't just check out and check out the Buddhists. You know, realize that disenchantment is actually maybe very healthy. And find some way then to find maybe a different kind of faith or different kind of confidence that's not doesn't involve kind of a hopefulness or expectation or a demand as part of it. But the connection to faith and disenchantment is an interesting one, because there's one 12-fold link or 12-fold chain of cause and effect from the state of suffering to the state of full awakening or freedom. It's a kind of a linear description of the different what kind of stages, I suppose, that a practitioner might go through. And
a 12-step program.
12-step program. And the first, it's not so much steps, it's more like the conditions. This is in place, that's a condition for this to happen. If this is in place, this is a condition for this to happen. And so it can kind of be seen as kind of things need to be cultivated. But the first condition is a condition of suffering itself, which is the common motivation for a lot of people to want to practice or look into practice, is they feel some kind of suffering. The next, on the condition of feeling one's suffering, that is a condition for feeling faith or discovering faith. So faith is discovered in many ways. You know, faith is discovered. You read a book, and the book seems to speak to your particular condition, and it inspires you. Oh, something is possible here. I can engage with it. Or this, you know, now I understand my predicament in a new way, and I'm inspired by that, and it's helpful for me, and I can sort out my life a little bit better. So some kind of, based on the suffering, faith is born. And I kind of like that, because rather than faith being born out of some wonderful ideal which lends itself to enchantment, it's actually born out of understanding our life as it really is. So that's the first step. And then somewhere like step 9 or 10 is disenchantment. And the stages are something, I can't remember them, but it's something like suffering, faith. And from faith is a condition for joy. And joy is a condition for happiness. Happiness is a condition for concentration, to get concentrated in one's practice. Concentration is a condition for seeing deeply into the way things are, seeing things as they are. Seeing deeply into the way things are, really seeing what they are, as opposed to our ideas and concepts and illusions of what they are, is a condition for becoming disenchanted. And being disenchanted in the way we're talking about this evening is a condition I'm kind of guessing at the stages, desiring liberation or moving towards liberation, something like that. Maybe Stephen, do you know that 12? Equanimity is everywhere in Buddhism. So it's kind of bad news. I'm sorry to give it unpopular. You know, it's kind of like someone, you're going into a movie, you know, and you're completely enthralled and entranced to what's going on the screen, and someone pokes you in the ribs and says, you notice everybody around you is eating popcorn? You realize, wait a minute, where am I? So, there's a place for going to movies. There's definitely a place for going to movies and getting enchanted and pulled into it. But we don't want to spend our life in a movie theater. So, hopefully, occasionally, we come out for fresh air. So any major reservations or before we end tonight? Since there were some earlier on. Yes?
Comment or question, I want to clarify. You said, accept my life as it is. That would include whatever longings or discontents are there.
Oh,
with that.
I don't remember what context I said that.
The
teaching of accepting ourselves as we are needs to be understood in a context. It's the practice of Buddhism is a practice where we're really hoping, I don't know if I'm going to use that word, but is a practice that leads us to less suffering. That's the whole project of Buddhism, is to suffer less and to be actually free of suffering entirely. The Vipassana tradition believes that one of the most powerful strategies, not for everyone, but for a lot of people, for reaching that, to suffering less, is to accept life and ourselves as it is in the moment. With, of course, using our common sense. We're not barreling down Oregon Expressway at 60 miles an hour and see a red light and say, well, I'm going to accept things as they are. I'm just going to keep going. But especially in meditation practice, in meditation itself, to really take who we are, including our feelings of longing and desire, and accept those, but not accept them to continue the enchantment, but to accept them in the sense of not further fueling them with attachment or pushing away, or guilt or aversion or ambition or whatever, but really to slowly begin to find the place that much more spacious awareness that can hold it all without getting entangled with it. And that's an extremely powerful strategy to do that, and that's a strategy of Vipassana. So now that I've succeeded in disenchanting you in something, maybe with Dharma talks, we will go home. Thank you.